Testing 1 2, testing 1 2.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi.
Hello, hello everyone.
Greetings.
We had a meeting earlier today with Matteo, Marco Massi, Doug, and Katina, and myself. And Katina, I think, was going to be here tonight. She said she would be, but I don't know if she will be. I don't think that Matteo or Marco will be. And Tony also posted that he wouldn't be. So we might wait for Lauren. And then if she doesn't show up in a minute or two, start a meditation. And then from there, go into the conversation. How are you all feeling?
Good. I did my homework, so.
When did you find time?
In about the last 2 hours.
That's a rapid ascent.
It is a rapid ascent. A bit of a holy in the sense of with holes in it rather than
maybe we'll poke some holes through the holes. Why don't we start a meditation?
I'd like to say that your bell work is getting better, Marco.
Thanks. I'm paying attention to it, practicing it. I noticed little imperfections, though. Like that second stroke was not quite, didn't quite have the crispness. But...
You're attempting to feed audio over other audio. So you might get the static of what we have coming from our audio.
Yeah. I felt a little, I started the meditation before John could kind of sit down and respond, because I had asked Jeffrey and you, Doug, how you were feeling. And I kind of wanted to get started, and I thought that might be, you know, what everybody wanted, but I didn't really know. I just went for it. So I did feel that, a kind of twinge around that. And so I would... you know, appreciate the chance to rectify that by asking John how you're doing and how your day has been.
It's been stormy. The last 2 days have been very difficult. But, you know, it comes in waves. So I fully expect tomorrow or maybe even this evening a wave of Satchitananda. Contraction, expansion, contraction, expansion. But otherwise, I'm fine.
Cool. Lauren, are you in a place where you could talk?
Yeah, hi. Sorry, I was just a little bit distracted there as we were beginning. I was on the phone with my lawyer a minute ago and found out some really good news. So, but I'm happy to be here and talking with you guys.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too.
I had mentioned earlier that Katina, Mateo, Marco Masi, Doug, and I spoke earlier today for almost a couple of hours. So this is like an intensive, ascent experience.
Nice.
And I'm a little bit flustered as to just how to begin this. I wanted to ask if you don't mind using the mountain metaphor, if we were to use that, since this is an ascent. And I think, John, you shared a mountain metaphor picture in a previous call.
I did. I think I have it here. Do you want to look at it? Or did you want to discuss that?
Well, it went zigzag, right?
There's also a ladder on the page, too.
Yeah, there's the ladder. Aurobindo and Wilbur, I think, are very fond of the ladder. And then I don't know if you can see this trail up the mountain. It loops around, and it gets to the summit eventually, but it's not like a straight climb to the top. Is that the one you're talking about, Marco?
Exactly.
Okay. I hope that's clear enough.
So if we were at the base of this mountain and we were looking up at it and trying to determine how we might proceed, what would be the best way up? Probably not straight up. that might be tough to pull off. But I wonder how we might sort of, you know, put our minds together, figure out our mode of ascent or our path of ascent.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I'm still trying to work out things from the experience that I had last week or week before last. And so you know, I read this chapter, and I presume it's not Supermind coming down and talking to me, but it felt like something like that. This experience of communion with a large universal presence that I felt about 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago. And I'm going through these waves of feelings that are partly joy and partly excruciating pain. So it's an odd, it's hard to not like the pain. It's hard to be, to be regretful of the pain because it comes with the joy. And the joy is wonderful, but the pain isn't exactly the most comfortable thing in the world to be present for either. So is this an ascent? I have no idea, but it's certainly not business as usual in my life. You know, it's a different state, and I'm still trying to. I went to see my psi today, my Jungian analyst, and he thinks it's an archetypal experience in the Jungian sense, and he he's probably right. But I don't think the one precludes the other. I don't think because it's a Jungian archetypal experience that involves the totality of being, that it's not also a spiritual experience on a different plane. So, I'm still trying to work all that out. So I'm sorry, I can't give you more hints about how exactly it ties into the text that we're reading, because I'm still trying to untangle what it means for me and where it's taking me. I don't know.
Just the metaphor of going up the mountain and trying to figure out which route is the best or whatever. The first thing that I thought was switchbacks, because that was the fastest and easiest way that I climbed one of the mountains in Yosemite. Just kind of like not going straight up, but you're still going straight up. It's like, it's just a different kind of way. It's a more gradual, and you don't get as exhausted going up. And you're also able to like turn and observe what's around you more than just on one straight trajectory. So you get more of like the feel of the mountain that you're climbing. And then a little bit of what you were saying, Jeffrey, just reminded me of my birthing experience and how, like, in one moment I was like, this is the most painful experience I have ever had, and I never want to do this again. And then by the time I'm touching my baby's head and he's coming out and into my arms, it was like none of that pain even mattered. It was like the teeniest little speck of pain in the midst of like the most bliss and joy ever. And I feel like that is definitely, at least for women, a major like spiritual experience and initiation to be able to go through. And it is an awakening, and it's like, it is like climbing a mountain as well, or like a bike ride that I took where we went 70 miles, and at a certain point, you think you're gonna have to give up. You're like almost there. You're almost at the top and you're like, I can't do it. This is just exhausting. Like, I'm never gonna make it. And then you get past this one certain point and it's like this rush of, I don't know, serotonin, adrenaline, whatever kicks in, and you can just charge the rest of the way up the mountain and go, and the pain is non-existent anymore. And it's this blissful experience. I think it's sort of like, last week, John, you were talking about looking at the shadow aspects of things and being aware of that. And the pain is that shadow, but it's a really necessary part for our growth, I think. And it's part of the struggle of climbing the mountain, but also the joy of it.
Yeah. it does feel like if I'm climbing a mountain, and I'm not saying that I'm not, it does feel like it's in the middle of a forest as well. So I don't get any distance. I can't see where I am. All I know is I'm surrounded by forest, and I'm still trekking away at trying to get somewhere, you know? So it's like, anyway, so because we tend to think of climbing a mountain as some sort of open space, but it doesn't have to be, right? It can be completely fogged in or occluded by the environment, right?
I like to think of my fog as the unknown, at least at this time in my life. But a lot of times I'm too lazy to make that journey beyond the fog. But I like the zigzag method. I forget the term you use for, I'm not a mountain climber, but I do have a...
Switchbacks.
Switchbacks. I'll use that from now on. But I go with my son down to my grandmother's creek, and there's one way you can take that's decent of a walk up and down, or you can go straight up from the creek directly to the house. And it is necessary to switch back, especially if you have a child on your back or you're carrying an extra load. And the first image that came to my mind was Chutes and Ladders. I don't necessarily like that game, but the ladder was right there. And I was thinking, well, just insert the ladder over here and we've gone from the bottom of the mountain to the top. It's that easy. But then the chutes come in every now and then. One thing we talked about in the earlier conversation, which I think was a good theme, and you can use the word however you wish, but it was maybe discipleship came, or servitude, not necessarily those words, but the idea around that. Go ahead, Marco, what'd you?
I think it was service.
Service,
there we go. In the sense of karma yoga, or in the sense mm-hmm. of like serving the divine in others or itself, not servitude, although, you know.
I think that was, yeah. Anyways, I'm not going to speak for Katina here, but she does throw in the more Christian side of this Eastern focus we've had. But she, it would have been, I hope she can appear later to give us a good summary of what she was working at there. But, yeah, go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I would love to talk to Katina about that. I was just reading earlier from William Irwin Tompkins' book, Coming Into Being. He has a large chunk on Aurobindo and Jesus and Aurobindo's take on Jesus. Well, I'll quote from him later, but I wanted to just show this. I made this little chart coming out of this book on this Aurobindo reader, and the bottom is the inconscient, the subconscient, the physical, the vital, the higher mind, the illumined mind, intuition, overmind, supermind, and Satchitananda.
Can you hold that out so I can like take a screenshot of it, the whole
thing? I'm afraid that I can't fit the whole thing.
Just back it up a little bit. Yeah.
You see that?
Whoops, I don't know if I can do the screenshot.
I wish I had paid attention to this little chart earlier, because as I've been reading the text with the chart, it's much easier to follow. And the other diagram, this is the Purusha and Prakriti. And you can see that nature, Prakriti, deals with the outer, mental, physical, vital. And the Purusha, the person, is dealing with the inner, mental, physical, and vital. So these two diagrams sort of help orient my, help me to orient when I'm reading this. I also will share something that happened to me after our last session. This is October 21st. I can't remember what day that was. It was, I think it was last week sometime after the Aurobindo reading. And I'm using a Tibetan practice. I do my, you know, my breath work. I'm lying on my, this is usually after I've had 2 or 3 hours sleep. Then I get up and do my yoga. And I'm lying on my back and I focus on the throat center and I use the a red A. This is a Tibetan practice in the center. And you just keep that focus and just allow whatever happens to happen. So I heard voices in a language that I don't speak, coming from my body. It was an interior voice. It wasn't coming out of my vocal cords. It wasn't externalized. And then I watched hypnagogia. And then I saw lots of forests. And then moving through these green forests. And I'm then I'm aware that I am walking towards a wooded area that becomes dark. So I'm walking in my subtle body and it becomes pitch black. My visual system goes to black, but I sense there are two female angelic beings on both sides of me. And they gently touch my left and right shoulder. So I have one on this side and one on that side. I walk with them and feel a strong current, and I feel a sense of trust. I see a flash of light. It's totally black, can't see anything. But then I notice this flash of white light. It's a thin beam of light, and it's spread in a long, thin, horizontal line right beneath me. And then the angels disappear, and I feel a strong male energy. It enters me from below, and I feel the energy flow up the spine, up into the head, and I cry out. This is quite ecstatic, and I offer a prayer to God, and that this could be shared with all sentient beings. And I am in a brilliant flame, ecstatic joy, and when it reaches a climax, there is a release into a stillness, an oceanic, boundless bliss, and I feel the presence of Rob. He's a very dear friend of mine who has Parkinson's disease. He's not doing that well these days. But I feel the presence of Rob in a gentle embrace. And we're near the sea, and I feel the lives we have lived in many dimensions, and a perfect peace, and a forgetfulness. And I don't really care if I remember or forget. It's kind of odd. And now everything's sort of getting very white. And I'm adrift for hours in this perfect zone. And then I return slowly to the physical body with a lightness and an ease, and curious how to remain open to the quality of the relationship to the life divine. All doubt has vanished. And what happens is I get up, my physical body, make coffee and get ready. It all seems to have be pervaded with this kind of lightness, which, by the way, I've not been able to maintain. Just takes a few hours being in the streets of Manhattan for it to vanish. but I remembered that I wanted to maintain that contact. And so I found a few techniques that I have used to sort of anchor that memory. As evasive as it is, I know that I had it. And that's a firm sense of that's a contact. But I have this little comment I want to make, and this may sound a little weird. It may be a little influenced by queer theory, but I also think it comes out of my experience in past lives as a priest and as a monk. Very Christian. Unless you become as a female, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. God is male. Humans are female. And I don't say, and I'm not saying feminine. I'm saying female. Oh boy. So that opens up a whole range of affects and liminal zones. But I think, and just to finish this off, I'd like to quote something that and William Irwin Thompson says about his reading of Aurobindo. And he, I think I mentioned before, he was in Oroville and he had contact with the mother. I don't think he had contact with Aurobindo directly, but he's read all of Aurobindo's books and he's followed him. And I just thought this was a very interesting quotation. I'd be curious how you'd respond. Aurobindo had, actually, I'd love to hear how Katina responds. Aurobindo had a low opinion of Christianity. He was educated by Irish nuns in India, went to boarding school in England, and then on to Cambridge, where he encountered the Church of England in the most boring Edwardian period of its life. When he came back to India and began to learn Indian languages and literatures, he became convinced that Jesus was nothing compared to Krishna. Krishna had this vast cosmic consciousness, but Jesus was simply a good man, a local prophet within a not very enlightened tradition, since the esoteric knowledge of the ancient Indian rishis is not exactly to be found in the Old Testament. Aurobindo's feelings for Christianity were weak to begin with, but as he developed his integral yoga, Christianity just drops out of the picture, and his appreciation of Buddhism was a typically Hindu one. He saw Nirvana as simply an extreme nihilistic variation of the Vedanta that dismisses the physical world. And just one more paragraph. When Aurobindo wrote The Secret of the Veda, he was ironically unwilling to discuss its secrets. He himself was not working within the tantric tradition. And later, when he went on to articulate his integral yoga, he would say that it was a mistake to try to awaken the force of Kundalini from the bottom of the spinal column, because that process of instinctive energization would generate all kinds of states of instability and madness. Aurobindo's yoga works from the top down, from the center above the head, and from behind the heart. In the goodness of time, these centers will reorchestrate the lower centers at their own appropriate moment of spiritual development, and therefore will not precipitate the kind of psychotic instabilities that occur when one tries to work from the instinctive level up to the intuitive. If one tries to crack open the spinal column and seek to force the Kundalini upward, then one is in for a very bumpy instinctive ride through the evolution of consciousness. The tantric path of illumination is a much more shamanic and wild process of instinctive transformation. Aurobindo was totally against sex and was absolutely forbidden in his ashram. Since he was separated from his parents as a tiny child, raised by nuns and sent away from India to boarding school in England at the age of 7, I doubt if anyone ever touched him in his life except to inflict the pain and punishment that is typical in English boarding schools. So it is a small wonder that Aurobindo has no use for sexual love or the affectionate touching of the human body. Well, I think his experience of the coming down, definitely, I think he's, and his warnings about coming up from below, I can appreciate that was his experience. It has not been my experience. And I have a very different experience. And I believe my body is organized in a very different way from his. So I'm just making the plea, borrowing a little bit from Aaron Manning, that every nervous system in every brain is a different nervous system in a different brain. Just like, you know, every blade of grass is a different shade of green. So I think we should all be a little suspicious when one model is being promoted, no matter how interesting or compelling it is, because one size doesn't fit all. So thank you.
I think if we're judging from just reading The Life Divine, he definitely doesn't go into Christianity or other religions in depth. But I don't see him as anti-Christian, at least from reading The Life Divine or seeing it as feeble or possibly incomplete or something. But he does the same with even the Vedic traditions and everything else. There's an incompleteness, and he's seeking the integral. But about the body part, I would agree with what you're saying. That, yeah, we do each have our own perspective. But I wouldn't know how to respond from Aurobindo's point of view, because he would probably add in quite a bit more than what I'm doing here.
Another thing, it just occurs to me, and this is probably pretty obvious, but in that all males have gone through the female in utero. As I understand it, it's the last phase that the male attributes start to form in the embryo after the female. So I think it's an add-on male thing. And of course, females are quite attached to that add-on. But I think at the subtle realms, I think we need to be very flexible with the identities that are formed in that outer circle, where the ego, of course, is basically a healthy ego is transparent enough so it can contact the subliminal self and negotiate in the physical world. But that's not always, but sometimes the ego gets totally immersed in the physical world and loses touch with those subtle realms. I think that's very common in most of us, especially in this transition we're going through. If you're using Gebser as a model, the mental deficient rational, the mental deficient structure is very powerful right now, and because it's probably, as Gebser says, on its way out. The most powerful expressions of a structure occur right before a new structure starts to become dominant. So perhaps if you're following that model, we have many models to follow. There's sort of an overlap, I believe, between Aurobindo and the supermind and Gebser and the emerging integral as the mental deficient starts to break apart. And I heard the stock exchange had us startled yesterday by a fall, 600 points, which means all the gains in 2018 have been wiped out. And, 2 weeks ago, they were shouting hurrah because, the stock market had hit a new high. So I'm just wondering you know, how long can we sustain this kind of divination process, really, that our whole economy is based on? It's a small group of people just in a crapshoot. And it's creating enormous havoc with you know, our relationship with nature. So I believe there are signs. If we want to find them, it wouldn't be hard to find a good case for the mental deficient being extremely stressed right now and probably getting inflamed and exaggerated.
What's the story Aurobindo is telling here? Like, how do these stories fit together? If they do, you showed the image of his levels, his sort of ascent from the incontinent through matter, vitality, mind, and then the various kind of higher mind. Illumined mind, intuitive mind, over mind, super mind, Satchitananda, right?
You get a gold star for that.
And he is careful to say that this evolution, this whole process of super mind divinizing the cosmos doesn't happen in a linear fashion, that each of the levels, each of those domains of being have their own entities, their own forces, their own powers, and that they're always acting and interacting. And even as, you know, consciousness ascends, there's also a descent of supermind. And ascent and the descent meet, as those currents meet, there's admixture. And so the lower is energized and spiritualized by the higher, and the higher is kind of diminished and fragmented or disabled in some ways by the lower. But then he's, I think, positing and intuiting that the overall process results ultimately in the governance of, in the predominance of, in the full expression of the highest. So supermind divinizing the whole cosmos. That's, I think, that's the vision. That's what he sees happening. And, you know, that also individuals can experience pieces of that. Individuals can experience that in this partial way through the ascent of their psychic being through the various, you know, up that mountain. And then he tells the story of what those gradations of ascent would be. The higher mind being focused on thought, the illumined mind being focused on vision, the intuitive mind having just immediate grasp, immediate knowledge through a direct kind of connection with overmind. Overmind being the principal kind of dividing force, like the first mover, or so he doesn't use that language, but the one who can create different kinds of worlds and different possibilities, whole different logics, whole different universes, I think, essentially. And then there's supermind, which is the ultimate, right? And here we are, humans, kind of in the middle of it all. Like, we're at this juncture where the ascending currents, the striving and the desiring and the eros, is meeting with the descending currents of the divinizing light. And it's breaking apart, and we're experiencing that breakup. And so the stock market or the political, you know, I don't even know what to call it really anymore. It's a kind of big mass of I think what I'm coming to see is that mostly pointless activity, that it's the longer game of is more important. And so the exploration of the subtle and getting a becoming conversant with the subtle and the social dreaming, like I think that's the future. Like what the breakup that we're seeing in the stock market or the political polarization or whatever happens in the elections coming up, and that's just even the American context, that we're going to suffer through it one way or the other. And you know, some of our bodies may be subject to that, you know, depending on where you are. In Manhattan, you're vulnerable in different ways than you are in Colorado.
We're underwater is what's going to happen. If it raises 3 degrees, Manhattan will be underwater. That'll be really bad for my commute because I live on Second Avenue. It's a very inconvenient truth.
Right. So, but I mean, how do you feel about this larger story? How do you feel about this larger, because there's no guarantee that this happens in this particular, on this particular planet, in our particular era or epoch. I mean, this could all just collapse and then would have to start up again. And that would just presumably keep happening. And occasionally Supermind would win or something like that. Am I making sense of this?
Yes, you are. There's so many times when I feel really positive that, like, yeah, you know, even if it's not in my lifetime or even any time, like, close to my lifetime that humans achieve it, like I think that it's possible. I see this like movement towards it, but then there's other times when I'm just really like, I've been re-educating myself a little bit about certain things recently.
Hi Aurobindo, he says.
I've been re-educating myself a little bit on fluoride. I studied some toxicology in college and just trying to solve some skin problems on my son and thinking about all the ways, like, we got this whole house water system set up, but we only have a reverse osmosis drinking water spout. And I'm going, oh, fuck. He's fucking breathing in. I'm breathing in. We're all breathing in fluoride and arsenic and all these other things that aren't filtered out in just a basic 4-stage filter. And we're getting full of it. And if you look at the history behind it, it's like evil fucking shit. You know, it's like these people who ran the aluminum companies, the people who were creating the Manhattan Project, are the same people who paid for it and they wanted to save their asses. And so it's stuff like that that I'm just like, is this evil kind of thing just going to always be a part of the world? Because it seems like it has been for so long. I mean, I don't know, because human history is... we don't really know that much, but I don't know. It's like, it really gets me frustrated because then I start feeling like, well, I'm surrounded by chemicals all the time. Even when I'm trying to eat organic and be as healthy as I can. And like, you know, so that I can be more in touch with my psychic being, because I honestly feel like the more healthy your body is, the more attuned you're going to be able to be to access all of these levels simultaneously, you know? And if you're not, if you're clouded from chemical buildup in your body, like it's really hard to get there because you're sick, you know? And most people don't even realize that they're sick, but they are. So it's things like this where I just like, I'm going back and forth and back and forth and like, maybe some of us are able to achieve it in this lifetime. Maybe that's always possible, you know? But then there's just moments where I feel like we have such a long battle still to fight. Like that this has been just that one example of fluoride, for example. It's been like a long time, and the studies are there. We know that it's bad for us, and yet we're still doing it. And it's one of the hardest things to remove from water. And so it's like, when is there going to be the tipping point when finally it's not added to the water anymore? But I mean, that's the same that goes with, like, you know, food production. Like, when are they going to stop spraying chemicals on everyone's food? It's hard because we don't live in small communities anymore, you know? Like, I think about, like, the Native peoples that lived in California and how incredible they were. And people didn't even realize that they were actually, like, practicing agriculture because they just... they saw them as gathering things, but they were actually tending the landscape. And the way that they lived with nature is so much different than the way that we, like, try to take power over it, like control nature instead of integrating with it. It's, I don't know, the modern world today makes these questions, like, really hard to answer, I feel like.
Well, it's very, it's, I share the heartbreak, really, when we're confronted with the evil that men do, lives after them. The good is often turned with their bones, so said Shakespeare. But I think you know, what you said too about, Micah, about tuning into the subtle, and to the social mind, the social dream. And they were all dreaming this dream together. We are weaving in and out of it. And sometimes we have total amnesia for it, as Aurobindo uses the veil. The veil comes down, the veil comes up, the veil goes down again. But I have found in that, like in that episode I tried to describe, that when the current starts to flow, you know, and you hit the jackpot, I rely totally on God language. I call out to God. And, you know, the only thing I can do is pray. And it just seems the most natural thing to do, because there's nothing you want for yourself, but you want everything for everyone else. There's just this incredible flow of generosity. And, I think that's the remarkable thing about these states when you start to ascend. And, you know, I look at this chart and, you know, you try to say, okay, how can I fit some of these experiences, these subtle experiences onto this chart? It's a waste of time. You know, it makes no sense. But I think that's where I would sort of like have a discussion with Katina about this, because she's a woman of faith. And for me, faith comes after God. To me, faith never generated anything useful, but more and more delusion. I had faith in this, I had faith in that, I had faith in this. And, you know, I'm not, so God isn't to me about faith. It's actually about a robust experience of something I will call divine, as I think Aurobindo does. And I can call it God. I don't care what other people call it. You know, I'm not much of a theologian, so it's not my field. I think I was in a past life very engaged in these kind of questions, but I'm not anymore. But I think there is a kind of, so when you come back to these, the constraints of the physical, you know, it can become a huge, because you're more sensitive, you can become very depressed. And I think that is a warning. And we have to sort of find a way of rebalancing, because we can become more sensitive and more vulnerable. But I also think there's an imprint that gets in our system, a very strong imprint. And even though the memory of an experience can fade, the imprint is still there. And I think having multiple subtle experiences, you start to realize when the constraints of the body are lifted and you're once again unified, you look at that experience in a very different way. And when you're in these states of extreme unity, you don't have that free of contraction. You can still recall the physical life. And then when you come And you want to remember. You want to remember. You don't want to forget. You don't want the veil to come back down. And you want to bring it with you. But I have not been particularly successful at that. So when I come back to my physical circumstances and the social, economic situation that I'm in, with the hostilities to my environment, it's a practice to try to maintain the quality of attention that I think is required to maintain that balance. So I think that's when you have to do your yoga or go for a run or do your breath work or whatever you need to do, or read spiritual literature, just so you can maintain an equilibrium. It's great if you have an ashram. I think it's much easier to maintain contact with these subtle realms in an ashram, but I've not been so lucky. And maybe that's not what this lifetime is for, is to be lucky. Maybe I'm one of the damned. And maybe that's a blessing. And maybe I've learned things that I would never have learned otherwise.
It's funny you guys like brought up the stock market and just all the ups and downs that have been coming in and the division, like, and it just, I was wondering, this last weekend you said, John, as well, that you had this experience on the 21st. I had an experience the day before that. Well, it kind of continued into the 21st as well, but it involved a friend in a social situation where he's not taking responsibility for his actions. He's not growing up and he's blaming me for all of his problems. Like, literally the confrontation ended with him telling me that I put a hex on him because I told him he was gonna probably die alone with his teeth rotting and falling out, because they are already rotting and falling out. It was a horrible moment because he just wouldn't listen to me about trying to get him to stop smoking cigarettes. And it was one of those, like, fucking wake up, your teeth are going to fall out. And his teeth, just one of them just did fall out recently. And he's blaming it on me, like some sort of, like I'm some witch. It's really funny. And everyone was laughing around him when he's screaming it at me in public. Just before that happened, I had this woman who was drinking, like, just come up to me and confront me and, like, give me this really intense whole spiel because I asked her to not stand in between my husband and I when we were dancing at the concert, and I was confused about what she was doing. It was just a weird experience, but it was like, I believe that we call alcohol spirits for a reason, and I saw that she was very drunk, and it was almost like something else was taking over her. And then just right after that experience, I went outside and was attacked by my friend, and it was just this weird, like, I wonder if this woman was picking up on, or whatever demons she's embodying with the spirits of alcohol she's drinking, was picking up on this psychic experience that was happening. And, you know, attacking me still for it. And then I started reading in this book called The Women Who Run with Wolves. And it's a collection of stories for women. A lot of it is to help find healing for things. But I found this one story really particularly useful just in the, like, in a context beyond sex, gender. And it really pertains to this idea of the psychic self and awakening to our supermind. And the story is Bluebeard, and it's this evil man who's really charming, and he sways these three sisters, and the youngest one of them decides to marry him, and she's, like, locked up in this castle, and he gives her all the keys to everything, but says this one key is this secret room you're not supposed to use and go into. And her sisters entice her to be curious and look, and they go and find the room, and they find that it's filled with dead bodies, and she realizes she's going to be next. And there's this whole story thread, and the main point being that there's a natural predator to your soul, your psychic being. And that natural predator is usually ourselves, our own fears, our own, you know, saying that we have shortcomings in certain areas, not believing in ourselves. It's that, like, I can't ever do that versus the I'm capable of doing anything I set my mind to. And I just found it really, really an interesting like wake up to have this person I know attacking me in this way and like putting all this intense feeling on me, because for years I felt horrible about saying that to him. That was like, I beat myself up about that for so long and like literally did believe that somehow I was going to be responsible for his teeth falling out too. And it recently I came to the, I finally was able to let it go and just be like, wow, I'm not responsible for that. Like, that was not, that's not how that works, you know? And I was able to let go of that. And I feel like that was a huge part of me healing my psychic being, like my super mind, you know, and being able to be more in touch with myself and not, I don't know, be tied down in like stupid things that don't matter. And, yeah, I just thought that was interesting, the whole, the predator of the psyche.
Mom, I can't get in you. I can't.
Another thing I just wanted to quote, or once more, from this coming into being, William Irwin Thompson. He says, Sri Aurobindo, if we're going to avoid the complete balkanization of the planet, we need to understand that the spiritual evolution of humanity to a higher level of consciousness, what Aurobindo calls the supramental manifestation, has turned religion into an evolutionary backwater of violence and sullen dissolution. And it goes on to say, there is a very good chance that humanity simply will not advance into a new planetary culture, and the prophecies of Sri Aurobindo will have to be put off for another time or another species. The triple assault of global pollution, universal violence, and technological transformation may simply prove too much for the humanity to bear. But since my life's work has been devoted to going against the mainstream of American culture by seeking to articulate this new planetary culture in an age of ethnic violence, seeking to embody a post-religious spirituality in an age of repopularized Super Bowl religions, and seeking to establish educational alternatives such as Lindisfarne, right at the time when giant communications corporations were consolidating publishing bookstore chains and electronic media, I shall carry on to finish what I started. And he was writing this in 1994. So really the gentrification was just getting started. It's much more extreme now than it was then. But I like the fact that he says, to hell with it, I'm still gonna go for it, you know? I sort of admire that. Even in the face of the demonic, which is all around us, as you were pointing out, Lauren, even good friends have these splits. And, it takes enormous courage to stay in relationship with people who, you know, good people who have these splits. And I've had many episodes like that. So I definitely resonate with that.
I feel like I've come to the conclusion that there are certain people that are toxic. Even if you love them deeply, they're just toxic. It's not a good relationship for you. And cutting those cords is probably one of the best things you can do for yourself. Like, everyone I know loves me, and I can't have somebody who's going to come up and scream at me and talk to me like that. You know, like, that's just not okay for me in my life. I will not accept that anymore. I'm not going to allow somebody to treat me like that. And that's huge. That's like serious empowerment. And then you're surrounding yourself with a certain type of
psychic energy and positivity that's realistic too. Like, I think that there's a big problem with like the new age movement, and like, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'd be talking about something and I'd have some little hippie kid go, "Posy vibes, only posy vibes here." And I'm like, dude, the world isn't sunshine, rainbows, and unicorns. I'm sorry. That's just not how it works, you know? And, but I'm a very positive person and I have a lot of, you know, like aspirations and vision for humanity's possibilities. I think we're a little bit dizzy with possibilities even, you know, but I do picture us being free someday and awakened. You're being silly.
Well, this chapter focuses on ascent and descent, but there's one part of it that I think relates really well with what you've been sharing. It's for the geeks out there, paragraph 42 in the chapter, and Aurobindo is talking about how, you know, Overmind wants to descend, wants to divinize matter, wants to divinize human life, like it wants to transform things in such a way that, you know, you don't have chemicals in your water, and you don't, and I'm sorry, I'm watching Aro. But he's talking about the complexities and that it's really not possible for Overmind to accomplish this. That's why Supermind is necessary. And the third complexity with respect to Overmind descending fully into matter is brought on by the power of the consciousness to live in more than one status at a time. Especially, a difficulty is created by the division of our being into an inner and an outer or surface nature, and the farther intricacy of a secret circumconscient or environmental consciousness in which are determined our unseen connections with the world outside us. And that's the part I underlined. The next few sentences are long, so I don't remember exactly what they said. But the idea was that we have this whole, our environment, everything around us, our social environment, our physical environment, is part of our extended consciousness that we can't directly change. I take that back. It's not that we can't directly change it, but it's that its change would be the result of this larger historical process succeeding, and so anyway, I'm watching them play, and I'm feeling myself being way too serious in this particular commentary.
Sorry.
I have a lot of practice with the energy of boisterous youngsters like that. What I got from that, the reason that passage was relevant to me and the reason that I remember it, was because part of what I think that implies is that we can take care of our individual body mind, we can kind of work on our own consciousness, we can work on our meditation, whatever it is, but our context, our living arrangements, our social sphere, our environmental sphere also has to be supportive of this evolution. And so it would be important, therefore, if we were committed to this ascent, if we actually wanted to live the divine life in the, you know, the totality that Aurobindo is, you know, saying is our destiny, saying is our, is, you know, the ultimate kind of purpose of doing all this, then we would be kind of setting up these, like we would be really caring for those spaces in a different way. We would be creating these pods or these sort of zones or these pockets or these, which I think, I mean, I'm trying to make the connection to what I feel like we're doing. Like we actually are working on it. Like we are, and part of this space here is not just, is not the vertical ascent. Like we're not up at the peak surveying, you know, the scope of human history and you know, looking at this kind of from a completion standpoint.
Like, it's a nice place to visit, but you can't live there.
Right. We have to live here.
That's right. Now. That's
right. And so how can we do that better? Like, how could we concretely do that better than we've been doing? Because I know what it's like to live in New York. I haven't lived in Manhattan. It's intense just visiting Manhattan, you know, talking about visiting, you know, the peaks of Supermind, you know, that's like the belly of the beast. That's like going right into the, you know, the power chakra, if you will, of the, you know, the Western catastrophe. So, you know, you have a whole another set of kind of almost like circumconscient, like filtering that you need to do that somebody in an environment like I live in or in California or somewhere else, Kentucky or Quebec, we have to organize our consciousness differently and we have to filter different things. Like I also have two daughters in the house, so I can't be, you know, hanging out in Supermind while they're screaming or hungry, or, you know, we have to get to swimming lessons or whatever it is that's going on. And I think that part of what I like about Christianity that I find is, at least in what I've read in Life Divine, is that there's more of the feeling of real life, of the human drama, of, you know, the act, the tangibility of our relationships, and it's so much more visceral, I guess, in that sense, like the human element, right? And that, of course, is the figure of the Christ as the, you know, the ultimate human sacrifice, the suffering, the but the embrace of incarnation, like the embrace of that, the full loving through that. I mean, I've had this conversation with friend Ben Williams, who's a professor of yoga studies and he's steeped in Hindu philosophy, Vedanta. His specialty was Abhivanagupta. But you know, many Christian commentators assign a special primacy, right, to the Christian interpretation, to the Christian narrative. I think that there's a kind of breadth in Aurobindo's thought, in Vedantic thought in general, where you could say that Christ was just, you know, one manifestation of Overmind or something like that, one incarnation of amongst an infinite possible variety of such beings, avatars or what have you. So there's a place for Christ in this. At the same time, the intensity of that experience of what it is to be a mother, what it is to be a father, what it is to be a brother, a lover, a man, a woman. There's something I think about that why would we be doing this if not for those experiences? Why would the point be to ascend to the top of the mountain and not to be who we are? So I'd like to hold both. I'd like to hold the ascent, and I'd like to hold the being right where we are and where I am. And I think that's where the sweet spot, I think. Maybe that's where the pain and the joy are not separate, where they deepen each other.
I totally agree. I always had a both and kind of philosophy instead of an either or. And there's something else I wanted to say to that. that reminds me of like the Christian stickers you see, NOTW, right? It's not of this world. And it just never really made sense to me. Like, even while like maybe there's, you know, there's these higher energies or something out there, whatever you want to call it. Like, why are we, what's so bad about this world that we need to escape and go somewhere else that's not this world? You know, like you're saying, like, why are we here if we're not meant to experience all of the joys and pains of life? It's a dance.
Yeah, when I was working on my novel, which I wrote about that, this thing called Third Testament, which links the different religions together, that the character goes through this series of conversions to each of the different religions without losing the previous conversions. And so they accumulate a sense of the commonalities of the different religions as they move through them. And my character started with Hinduism. And when I was traveling in Asia a couple of years ago, I was really struck by the Hinduism seemed to me, it's not just the travels in Asia, but I also spent time with a friend in Vancouver who was Hindu. And I was just struck by the joy of that people find in that religion and the sanctity of daily life within the way the rituals and the celebrations, every part of daily life is sacred, and everything has a special place, a special sense associated with it. And then, so unlike Aurobindo, although I do think that the commentary you read, John, earlier on was perhaps a very particular opinion about Aurobindo, because we've heard other opinions about Aurobindo that don't necessarily cleave to the same text that you were reading. So my character went from Hinduism to Buddhism, from Buddhism to Catholicism, but in particular the teachings of Francis of Assisi, because in some ways Francis of Assisi is the most Christ-like of the personalities that emerged over the period of time from after Christ lived. Francis of Assisi is kind of the closest in spirit to Christ, to Jesus Christ himself. And so the sort of Francis of Assisi gave a grounding in a way that could link to some of these other understandings of the world that you find in Buddhism and in Hinduism. And then from there in another book I've been working on, I have an integration of Islam and Taoism, which is an odd thing to link. But the reason I was interested in the linkage between the two is that I find that Taoism has a kind of a sense of submitting to the way, if you like. And Islam is a religion based on submission to God in a way that parallels Christianity but is different from Christianity. And so I found a link between Taoism and the submission that one finds in Islam that I found interesting. So I was able to bridge those two and then connect them back to the other religions. And then from there I linked to Judaism and then Aboriginal understandings of the world. And so it was like this series of linkages that go through the different religions in an attempt to sort of understand how they could link together. But Hinduism remains at the basis of the, it was part of an effort to link these things. And I don't quite fully understand my own choices in the process, but I do feel that Hinduism is particularly, and it was before I read Aurobindo that I did this. But I do think Hinduism has a particular role as an integrator in a way that Christianity does not. Christianity has done very poorly over history at linking to other religions in a way which doesn't impose its own understanding of the world on other religions. That's what Christianity tends to do. I find it tends to be a little bit more domineering, whereas Buddhism and Hinduism and some of the other religions are less imposing. They're more respectful of the differences across different religions. Anyway, it's somewhat my own personal take on things, but anyway, I put it out there for a different understanding of this mountain climbing that we're doing.
Well, I think it's the esoteric side and the, you know, the occult, and what's externalized in a religion to organize it and maintain, you know, hierarchies, and the Tibetans have them, and as the Christians, there's these, and they tend to be male dominant till, you know, our modern times. We've seen that change a little bit. So I think the post-religious spirituality that William Irwin Thompson is pointing to fits a lot of us. But that doesn't mean we throw away the Bible or don't look at, you know, the Hebrew literature. And I don't treat them just like literatures. I treat them as spiritual texts coming from a certain time, a certain place. And, you know, and the metaphors that were used by Jesus or by the Buddha or by their various teachers, Muhammad, were particular to back the culture. And it was shaped, and it shaped the culture, and the culture shaped those metaphors. So I think the mystical side of things interests me the most. And I think that's what interests Aurobindo the most as well. And that's going to be different for every person. And whatever religious training you've had is probably going to color that quite a bit. Or if you've had no religious training at all, you could be totally agnostic and have these mystical experiences. So I think I am sort of postmodern in the sense that I don't think they're all pointing to the same experience. I think I'm getting this from, I can't remember his name. Jorge Ferrer. He's written a book, several books on this. And I heard a talk on him recently, and I read one of his books, and he's a critic of Ken Wilber. But I think his take is that all of these traditions are not pointing to the same thing. That each tradition is a unique sort of configuration and is doing something different. And it's not over. We could add something to each of these traditions or start a new one. And, you know, create our own metaphorical constructs emerging out of the experiences that we share and that, you know, so that it makes sense to us. I think we should be open to that possibility.
I think, Jeffrey, what you're doing in the novel, from what you've described, which you talked a bit about at the Gebser conference, perhaps it's a way of creating a more timely, by which I mean more suitable for our, you know, context, our modern context, like in actual integrations of what's insightful, what's visionary, what's useful, what's helpful, what, you know, the particular gifts that the religious traditions offer, because for all of the strife and warfare and, you know, other kind of factionalizing, balkanizing dynamics that they've set in motion, they also all have their ways of divinizing daily life and creating rituals around the significant events of life, birth, death, union, and so forth. And, you know, I know that culturally there's a resurgence of a sort of almost counter morality to the chaos. Like there's a desire to find basis, like basis for human culture, basis for civilization, you know, that are more adequate than the modern mental, rational, capitalistic, materialistic kind of driven ones are. So part of what I think the work that you're doing, which I think John is also pointing to, is that we are in a position where we can tell new stories, but they can be grounded in the human experience that has all the human experience that has occurred so far. I feel like I'm starting to sound like Ken Wilber, but it's partly because I saw a video of him speaking with Father Thomas Keating. My friend sent me this morning.
I love Father Keating. He's a wonderful man.
He really is. And this video, it brought back memories because this was an event, I guess, in Denver, probably in 2004 or 3 or 4. And Ken was in his prime. He was sharp, lucid, and Father Keating was there, and I asked a question in this video. I'll share it on the forum later. Maybe, I think Katina might like to see it. Because it actually had to do with this relationship between the personal relationship one has with Christ and then the more ecumenical kinds of experiences that people have who follow other paths or no path. And Keating gave a very interesting answer, and more than interesting, I mean, he there was something very special about him. He's near the end of his life at this time. He's quite advanced in age, and so that's why my friend sent me the video. But Ken's answer was also interesting.
Please post it. I would love to see it.
Sure. And Ken used a Buddhist concept to kind of answer the question. And he said that in the Buddhist conception, there are three main domains of being, three kinds of body. There's the nirmanakaya, which is the gross physical body and the realm of physical relations. There's the sambhogakaya, which is the subtle realm. So that's the realm of dreaming, of subtle body, of energies, of visions, everything that in Aurobindo goes from the higher mind to intuitive mind is sambhogakaya. And then there's the dharmakaya, which is the body of truth. So that would be the infinite, Satchitananda or supermind. And so the the Christ figure has those three bodies. So it shows up historically as the person of Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, you know, born zero, in the year zero or whatever. That's his gross body. But he also has a subtle body, and he also has the Dharma body, which is the Godhead and the union with the Godhead. And so there was a way of understanding the Christian tradition in the terms of the Buddhist tradition through this metaphysical concept of multiple bodies. It was a way of making sense, in other words, of that article, that question of faith. How is it that you can believe that Christ was risen? Like, what does that mean, that you can have a personal relationship with that risen Christ, or that Christ can become risen in you, or that you could experience that resurrection in your own being, your own soul? And so that, what am I trying to say? I think that that was a worthy conversation. That was a worthwhile conversation. If we're considering, you know, the situation that we're in politically, ecologically, it's, and so on, I mean, one of the real things that we could be doing to at least plant the seeds of moving beyond that would be to be continuing that integration, like continuing that process. So I really like the fact that Katina is reading Sri Aurobindo and producing these amazing notes about it. These, you know, very detailed, very well organized, very thoughtful and insightful notes. And then that others are becoming curious about her path and her faith. It's interesting because it's interreligious, but it also transcends religion, because then we can also have the scientific perspective or wisdom or knowledge. We could also have the artistic. When we're kind of doing something integral, I think, and a part of me resists that because of, you know, my experience with that, you know, the attempt to do that through Integral Institute, and my own personal historical experience. But that's not as important as the actuality of what we're doing. And so I don't know if I have a final point to that, but I want to say that I appreciate, like, Lauren, for example, sharing even your personal experiences. They have, you know, theoretically, we could maybe try to, you know, apply Aurobindo's model and see where they fit, like on what level or whatever, you know, that they're happening. But I feel that it's just like part of the idea of having the space. And this is a very different conversation than the one this morning, which was much sort of trying to like be in the overmind or be. I hope that it gives us a sort of way to take a few steps along that path of ascent. And I wonder too, I mean, I'm curious how that, if that is what it feels like, and that's what it feels like we're doing. Are we on the path yet? Like, did we take a couple of steps? Is there a dragon down this path? Should we have taken the other path? Is there some kind of pitfalls? Like, how are we doing in this occasion here?
I feel like just the fact that we're here talking about it tells us that we're on the right path. That's my take. You know, most people aren't talking about these things. I mean, the average person in hospice dying is still fighting with their family over petty things until the day they die. They're number one even asking these kind of questions. So I think we should like congratulate ourselves for at least being aware enough of things and having the questioning mind to keep looking deeper, you know, within ourselves and seeing that in the world.
I think maybe the post-religious part of it, as we're saying, this is post-religious right here. We're not necessarily attached to Aurobindo's point of view or discussing it, nor are we attached to the Christian point of view, nor are we even attached to each other's point of view. But and we find religion in science fiction with another book we've read. It's all over these religious aspects. I found it in Butternut Squash and the Ariadne's poem she wrote, growing in my backyard, and relating that to some beautiful words that she wrote. And season, or for me, it spoke of seasons and life and death. A little bit better than Aurobindo can do at times, or in that certain moment. But I guess I'll share something which comes out of, I've been getting out my doodle pens a little bit more, all the nice little colors. I'm doodling. Was inspired by a Wednesday conversation and John was there. But I mentioned wanting to go back to some notebooks that I did. And it was a notebook that happened to be the first time I read Aurobindo. And it's they're really cool doodles. But it's very cosmic and colorful. But I called it Being Active and Aware. Now, I was reading Aurobindo at the time, but this reads just like something Lauren Olamina would write in the, what was her book? The Book of Change? No. Is that right?
Parable of the Sowers?
Parable of the Sowers. No, what was her actual document that she was writing?
Oh, the Books of the Living. It's Earthseed.
Books of the Living.
Yeah.
But I had written this, I guess it was 10 and a half years ago now, but it says, to begin, one must be willing to change. The state you are in is subject to change. All around us is change, or a form of change. Even the ground you stand upon will change. To control your life, you learn to control change. To control change is to be willing to change. And then I didn't say God has changed like the character does in the book, but so I say, where to begin, what to choose to change. There may be no definite answer. And I go on into journal entries, but it's interesting how that idea of religion, for me, I was tying in Aurobindo with my daily life. And clearly I saw that change was important. And for Octavia Butler in the Parable of the Sower series, or the parable series, we learned that she was writing these as kind of daily aspirations for her to get through her day, that recognizing life has changed and proceeding from that unknown quality. So that's for me, my post-religious thought is that there is an uncertainty of how we got here or where we're going even. Or how to get where we're going, even if we don't fully know where we're going. So we need help along the way. We need friends. We need people. So that's my religious feel for the night, I guess. But you are my religion.
So I liked, John, what you said about the religions are maybe after something a little bit different, each from each other. I think that's true. It's part of why I kind of interested in this process of the relationship between the religions, because I think obviously what's common to them all is humans are involved in all of them, right? So the commonality is the human being, But the way the human being gets involved in these different religions is different. And so there's something else going on there. It's not about the one God. It's about different understandings of the luminous, right? And different relationships with the luminous, with the divine. So anyway, I think that's part of what I'm trying to do with this novel and this series of books, to try and understand something about what's going on, because I feel like we haven't quite got there yet in terms of the general culture. The general culture tends to put these things in opposition to each other, as if there was some ultimate truth. And this is part of my own difficulty with the ideas of truth. You know, I don't think there's a single truth that we should be fighting over, you know, that one person or one culture or one group has the truth and the others don't. You know, I don't think it works that way. I think truth is something that has inconsistencies built into it. And so you can't come up with a single truth because inconsistencies are built in. And the other thing I wanted to say about the demons, to come back to the discussion, I can't remember, Marco and Lauren, and so in the experience that I had 2 weeks ago of this merging with a kind of universal state of being, I think I mentioned it in the brief note I put into the thread on the dreaming that you guys have been doing, that I have had a series of dreams or visions, I don't know whether they're one or the other, in which there are malefic beings that are watching over and commenting on the things that I'm doing, so that this experience of union or communion has been framed by a series of counter presences that are much more malefic than the sort of intense, so light and whiteness and some of these other things that are going on with the union sense. And I was talking about the experience when I was out in Colorado with Heather, and Heather mentioned the demon figures that you have in Hindu. So the gates are all guarded by demons, right? So because there's this sense that when you're dealing with the world of the numinous and the divine, there are darker things going on. And so so different cultures have put and symbolized these darker forces in different ways. The Christians have their way, the Hindus have their way, the Buddhists have a somewhat different way as well. But they all have these sort of demon figures. And so in a way, so she was sort of saying the guardians of the light, if you like, are the demons. So they have a positive role, even though they're demons. They are actually there because they guard something, they protect something in the process. And so that's a kind of an interesting understanding of what's going on as well. So anyway, I'm not sure that Aurobindo talks about it so much that way, but I do think that it is relevant to the discussion. So.
I think that's fascinating, because I have lots of demon stories, but I agree that with Heather that they're like threshold figures, and I've always sensed that if they scare you enough to make you back down, then that's probably healthy, because what's on the other side of that may be something you can't handle, but if you can. If you recognize them as a thought form and you can dissolve them, then you're ready to cross over. And take responsibility for whatever happens next. And it may not be pretty. There's always huge risks involved. But I remember one of my favorite stories, actually about demons, a psychotherapist told me, he knew a Tibetan, I don't know if it was a lama, it wasn't a lama, but it was a Tibetan practitioner from Tibet, practicing Vajrayana, you know, practitioner. And somehow they were watching The Exorcist. You remember that movie, The Exorcist? About the movie star, and she has a little daughter who's possessed.
Yeah, I never watched it. I don't like horror films, so I never watched them. So.
It's really very dramatic. If you've seen it, you won't forget it. But they were watching this exorcist and exorcising the demon from this little girl. That's what the movie's about. And this Buddhist practitioner was making these making all these noises, and the psychotherapist said, after the movie was over, said, I'm really sorry, you know, this obviously upset you. Maybe we shouldn't have watched this. And the Tibetan guy said, what upset me was how that Catholic priest was so stupid. How could he, you know, I like the demon, you know. I thought the demon was very charming, but why was this priest being, his behavior was so crude. And I thought that was such a delightful kind of comment on different traditions and how different traditions work with these encounters, with these dramatic and sometimes alien others. But I remember I went to these really very weird demonic experiences. I went to a Buddhist, who a practitioner I greatly admired, and he was recommended by others. And I told him some of the experiences I had, and he says, "Well, what you're describing is pretty rare. It doesn't happen very often. But the bad news is, no one can help you with this. You're on your own." And I was like, "Oh, great." Well, in a way, that was a relief, because there's no wrong way, you know. There's no right way. There may be lots of wrong ways, but I was on my own. Sort of, he sort of suggested to me. It gave me a sense of confidence that I was going to be able to figure this out. And if he had given me a prayer or some sort of ritual, I probably would have used it for a few days and just dropped it, you know. And I think he knew that. But I do think that these things are very, very real and need to be dealt with. And there could be all kinds of explanations for them, from, you know, something in your diet or some trauma that you had as a child, or, you know, you can psychoanalyze this stuff if you want. But I do think there's something on the other side of that. So it's worth persevering.
And, so you're saying I'm stuck with it on my own too?
Good luck, pal. But I also think a friendly attitude towards some of these demonic energies is very successful. If you can get rapport with them, they can be very charming and extremely seductive. And I think we think of Faust, and we think of Mephistopheles, and we think of Beelzebub, you know, and we think of all these, and I've asked them questions. I asked, "Who are you?" And they can give you lots of different answers. So this is one of the things that I was writing about in my short story, which I shared with you guys in the underground. You know, it's very puzzling. But I do think, I do believe that at a certain level, we're not just working on our own stuff, and this isn't about us. I think we're working on something, because once you take care of your own shadow, guess what? Now you get to work on the culture's shadow. And when you finish up that the culture shadow, then you have to work on the species shadow. And the shadow is always with us. And I think the idea that we're just going to get rid of it and sweep it under the rug is just ludicrous, especially right now. Because I think we're, you know, at a threshold. And I think there are lots of demonic energies that are working on Wall Street right now. they seem to be attracted to those kind of occupations. So anyway, thank you for sharing that, Jeffrey.
Yeah, it reminds me again of that story I was sharing of Bluebeard, and it's like so important to be aware of the shadow and that predator of the psyche. And like once you're aware of it, your curiosity, your psychic abilities, your like everything is much more enhanced once you're aware of that shadow, because it's like you said earlier, like you can take responsibility for yourself. That's huge. It's like I just turned 30 this year, and that feeling of like being an adult finally and actually looking back at my life and going like, okay, I've got to take responsibility for my actions and choices, and become so much better of a person when we look at that and we don't try to run from it.
The Bluebeard story is interesting because, of course, it ties to sexuality, and sexuality is one of those parts of human experience which connects us to the very best in ourselves and the very worst in ourselves, right? So it's one of the reasons why I find the whole subject totally fascinating.
And that's what I miss in Aurobindo. I think he has an ascending attachment to this, you know, these up here. And a little derogatory about the lower chakras, but I think it's actually, this is my intuition, this is where the cutting edge is in humanity right now. It's in the root and it's in the sex center. And I think there's, from my own personal experience, I think there's, I would say we're being remodeled. I think it is a mutation. And it's a grand experiment, and we're all involved in it to some extent. So I don't know if it's going to be successful or not, but I don't think that, my feeling is these higher ascendant, I don't think they have all the answers. I think actually we're on the ground. And I think it's our responsibility to make a good report so that these levels can be coordinated in a more just and reasonable way. So I think our rational minds, we need to hold on to, and hold on to the ego too, because you're going to need it to make these kinds of negotiations happen. And, you know, I just don't think our traditional monastic arrangements have been very good at this at all. I think they basically said, let's just drop that sexual thing and let's all become nuns and monks and, you know, get squirted up off the top of our heads and go into nirvana.
If we were going to like get to a place where we could evolve to live forever or something, maybe we don't need sex anymore.
I'm great. I like the idea of the rainbow body and the resurrected body, and I think you can work, and I think if you want to do that, you're going to have to go through the root in the sex center. You can't evade that, because I don't think any of us would be here without the root in the sex center. It's not just all the centers are working together, and we have to integrate all of them. And I think we can have more effective, subtle experiences that we can integrate when the whole system is engaged, rather than, oh, let's just take the heart, the throat, let's just do the top four and just let's suppress the rest or pretend that they don't matter. My experience has been very different because I, you know, was thrust in certain circumstances very early on, realizing my erotic nature was not the norm. And I sort of had to find others who shared that particularity. And it's taught me a lot, but it's taken its toll as well. But that's why that's what I miss in Aurobindo. I feel like he's I sort of agree with William Aaron Thompson that I think that he hasn't included the sex center at all. And I don't get any, now I don't think he's very concrete. I think he's, you know, magnificent abstractions upon abstractions upon abstractions. But anyway, that doesn't take away from the power and the beauty of his writing, which is, he is quite splendid. And what he does well, he does better than anybody else, for sure.
Yeah, I think you can't really have one without the other, and that the lower chakras are super important. And like, think about, like, I think about children and how... sacred that is, as like, and how we can be like so robbed of our vital energy if we are, say, like abused in that way as children. And like having healing in that part of ourselves, I think, is so essential for any sort of ascent. And then right now in the social sphere, I think we're seeing a lot of it. And it's not just like women speaking out. It's so much more than that. That's just like one facet of what we're seeing happening. And that's huge. I mean, whether or not it's gonna get action like the Kavanaugh guy to not be elected or whatever, that's not the point. The point is that women are speaking up and people are speaking up, and we're not willing to put up with that kind of thing anymore. And we're seeing how important it is to integrate ourselves.
I'm reminded of my friend Marie-Louise, who teaches breathing control and how to breathe. And all of her lessons about breathing are based on connecting to the perineum, because that's where the body's breath is grounded. And so if you just stuck with the upper chakras, you'd completely miss the basis of breathing in the body.
That's right. You can blow a fuse. You need those lower centers to be open and to ground the energy centers.
Yeah.
The whole thing doesn't work without the lower chakras being very, very vibrant, very healthy. So I agree with that.
And you can even do that with, like, you know, you guys are maybe familiar with the idea of grounding. People sell like grounding mats, even with the ideas, you know, if you walk barefoot on the earth, negative ions can travel through your body and actually ground you. And that's how important that is. And just like that, just again reminds me of like the importance of connecting with nature, and that's lower chakra kind of stuff as well, like the vital.
And I actually, my theory is, I think a lot of our sexual addictions comes from a block in the sex center. If the sex center is open and healthy and in alignment with all the other centers, you don't necessarily want to run around and have sex with a lot of people. It doesn't interest you that much. So I that's my feeling, is a lot of the imbalances we see in our narcissistic, sexually, you know, highly charged culture, selling sex all the time. I think those are signs that our lower chakras have not been, we're not attuned to them, and that we block them. And so we exaggerate in our behaviors that lack of integration.
So maybe
to come back to our opening question, how do you climb the mountain? Maybe what you need to do is you need to take your lower chakras down as you take your upper chakras up the mountain. You need both in order to climb the mountain.
You need to tunnel into it?
Yes.
That's one of the things that's so brilliant, by the way. This is totally off base, but about Tolkien and about the Fellowship of the Ring and the different characters, because there's light, subtle characters like the elves. There's earthy kind of underground characters like
the dwarves.
The dwarves, yes. And then there's humans who have their own ways, and all of them are aspects of our being who have a role to play in this quest to, to defeat the forces of darkness, essentially. And it requires great courage and great sacrifice. And one of the littlest among them has to go and, deliver this power, sacrifice that great power of the ring to the, to the abyss. But I think that it's a different kind of story. You know, when each character, each in Aurobindian terms, each center of consciousness or each center of power has a real positive role to play in the unfolding of the whole narrative. And so I think that that's another way of thinking about it than ascent. It's more than the hero's journey. It's more of the going outwards and then coming inwards, or going into darkness and then coming through into some resolution of darkness and light. But it's in there too. I think that there's an Aurobindian way of reading interpreting what we've been talking about. In this chapter, he speaks about how the overmind comes down, and it can't just impose its will on the lower nature. It has to work with it. It has to achieve its consent. Some of his language still has the colonialism in it, and he uses the war metaphor around how the higher has to occupy territory and kind of make these incremental gains on the ignorance. And I understand that that's coming out of his experience, and it's coming out of a certain time and place. And maybe we're more sensitized to that now than modern writers were, writers at that time. So I appreciate this chance to share with you all. And it's also interesting that we had these two two calls today, and they were very different. And I would say the first one was very ascending, and that this one was very descending. We talked about descent in the first call, but we didn't really descend. In fact, the idea was to spiral up, and here we've been kind of spiraling down. So maybe that's also part of the wholeness, of the thing, what we're doing. That's all I'll say.
It's like, if you're going to climb the mountain, are you going to stay up there, or are you going to come back down at some point? In my experience,
I'm going to take a selfie while I'm up there. And then I'll come back down.
Experience, once you're up there, to come down, and then you can go back up and down all over again, and like bring that bliss of being able to be on top of the mountain all the way down with you into your everyday life. Daddy.
I mean, I personally like the valley quite a bit, so I'm very drawn to the valley. Thank you all.
Yay, but you walk through the valley of death?
You're no evil, that's right. Thank you all.
I had a lovely
conversation.
Lovely, yeah,
it's been a good one.
See you next time for the Gnostic Beanie.
Yes.
Next time.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Have a good night, guys.
Have a good night, guys.
Good night.
Good night.
Definitely awake.
Thanks. Say good.